Here in the WBAI studios are Bayard Rustin, Executive Secretary of the War Resisters League, and Malcolm X, Minister of Muhammad's Temple of Islam in New York. Both of you gentlemen are working in your own ways for the welfare of the American Negro. And the first thing I'd like to ask you is if you would describe the purposes of your individual organizations and tell us something about the philosophies inherent in them. Mr. X.
Yes, sir, Mr. Donald. And I'm happy to be here today to represent the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to your audience. And as you know, Mr. Muhammad is the spiritual head of the fastest growing group of Muslims in the Western Hemisphere. And he perhaps is probably the greatest drawing card among the so-called Negro masses, more so than any other so-called Negro leader today. And proof of which, a year ago in Washington, D.C., he appeared at the Uline Arena and drew 10,000. And in New York at the St. Nicholas Arena, last year he drew 10,000. And this year, I think he drew another between 10,000 and 15,000. In Chicago, he drew 15,000. And I cite these things just to show you that as a man, no matter what people, whether they agree with him or disagree with him, they have to admit that the masses of the so-called Negroes are interested in hearing what he has to say. Probably in the past 2 years, he has become the America's most talked about and most written about black man. And even at the present time, I'd say he's one of the most controversial topic, namely because he's having such miraculous success in getting his program over among the so-called Negro masses. And if you ask me what it is, I can best tell you what it is by what he is credited with doing. The Time magazine last year, in an article about Mr. Muhammad, pointed out that he has successfully eliminated from among his followers the use of alcohol, which is one of the things that has destroyed our people here in America as a race. He has successfully eliminated dope addiction, profanity, excessive profanity, which actually stems from disrespect of self. He has successfully eliminated stealing and crime among his followers. He has, Time magazine also pointed out that he has, Mr. Muhammad has been successful in eliminating adultery and fornication and prostitution and making the black man respect his woman, something that has been characteristically absent among our men. And Time magazine also pointed out that among the Muslims who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, juvenile delinquency has been eliminated. And in the U.S. News and World Report, about a couple months later in 59, they pointed out that Mr. Muhammad was successful in making the so-called Negroes see the importance of an economic program that would, in fact, when you think of what Time magazine said, they were giving him credit for being probably one of the greatest moral reformers that has appeared among the so-called Negroes here in America yet. And when you tie in what the U.S. News and World Report magazine said concerning his success at getting the so-called Negroes to set up stores and factories and farms to feed ourselves, grow food for ourselves, factories to manufacture things for ourselves, and places of business to create jobs for ourselves. The point behind this particular phase of Mr. Muhammad's program is to make the so-called Negro economically independent, to keep him from having to embarrass the white man by demanding that the white man give him a job, when he can actually, Mr. Muhammad feels that our people can get together and pool our resources and our talents and whatnot and make jobs for ourselves. And lastly, I'd like to say that what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is teaching is not what we have been accused of, nationalism. Nationalism, the difference between being a Muslim and a nationalist, nationalism is the political approach or a political solution to the problems that confront the so-called Negroes in America. The aim of the black nationalist is the same as the aim of the Muslim. The Muslim and the black nationalists have no differences in objective. We are pointing toward the same goal. But the difference is in method. Method. The black nationalist, wherein he relies on a political solution to the problems that confront the so-called Negro, we as Muslims believe that the only solution to our problem is a religious approach. And this is why we stress the importance of a moral reformation. As a rule, the black nationalist will not talk to you about God or any religion or any kind of moral uplifting of the moral values. Whereas the Muslim, he stresses first to raise the moral standard of the so-called Negro, and by doing this automatically, it tends to give him more dignity and self-respect, and it elevates his thinking to the point where he begins to think in terms of doing something for himself, rather than to sit around and beg somebody else to share with him what they have amassed for themselves. So I would like to stress that Mr. Muhammad is not a politician. He doesn't believe that politics is the solution to the so-called Negro's problem. He says that the primary ingredient involved in our solution, it will take God. God himself has to have a hand in it, especially because the problem of the so-called Negro is so unique. His problem is different. The problem of the so-called Negro in America is different, perhaps, than the problem of any black people anywhere on this earth since the beginning of time. And so our entire approach is a religious approach. We believe that every condition that the Negro is in today was preordained, predestined, and prophesied. And we believe that we're living in the fulfillment of that prophecy today. We believe that our being here in America is in terms of biblical prophecy. We believe that the slave master's oppression of us is in line with biblical prophecy. And we believe that all of the trouble that the slave master is having on this earth today, all over the world, is all in line with the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And we also believe that Mr. Muhammad's presence in America in the midst of the so-called Negroes and his reason for teaching what he's teaching exactly as he's teaching it is all in line with the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. So the one thing that I would like to stress is our program is strictly a religious program. Our solution is a religious solution. It's not a political one.
But, Mr. X, does this involve the creation of a black state in America?
Yes, answer you like this. It involves the creation of a black state for the black man, if not in America, somewhere on this earth. If not somewhere abroad, then right here in America. But primarily it involves the acquisition of some land that the black man can call his own here or somewhere else. If the powers that be don't want it here, then they should make it possible for it to be somewhere else. If they don't want it to be somewhere else, they should make it possible for it to be right here.
It does have some political characteristics then.
Any religion, if by politics you mean the freedom and the rights of the black man, any religion that doesn't take into consideration that particular ingredient that involves the freedom of the black man is the wrong religion. But politics as such is not the solution. But the divine solution would have to have that particular ingredient in it. You can call it politics if you want, but I wouldn't call bread salt. It has salt in it. Salt is one of the ingredients. Yeast is one of the ingredients. Flour is one of the ingredients. And the overall problem of the so-called Negro in America is not a political problem as such. It's an economic problem. It's a social problem. It's a mental problem. It's a moral problem. And it's a spiritual problem. So we need a solution that doesn't deal with politics alone. What good does it do a man to be politically free and at the same time be economically dependent upon the man who gave him the so-called political independence? Why, he's still a slave. So we feel that since all of these ingredients are involved, only God himself can give a solution that will solve the whole thing. And this is the solution that we feel the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is teaching among the so-called Negroes here in America.
Mr. Rustin, could we hear from you?
I am very happy to be here, and particularly anxious that Malcolm X and I should clarify some of these questions which he has brought up in my mind. I would like to state very simply what it is that I believe and feel. I believe that the great majority of the Negro people, the black people in this country, are not seeking anything from anyone. They are seeking to become full-fledged citizens. Their ancestors have toiled in this country and contributed greatly to it. The United States belongs to no particular people because of race, color, or creed. People have come from many parts of the world to construct it. And it is my view that the great majority of Negroes take as their key word, and the great number of Negro leaders, the term integrate, which means that rightly or wrongly, they choose to become an integral part of the United States. I believe that we should work politically to the degree that that is possible, but I also believe that, and through the courts, but I believe that at the moment we have reached that point where the justice and freedom for the Negro people will come about largely because they, with a sense of dignity and pride, organize themselves to demand to become an integral part of all the institutions. And thus, such things as the Montgomery protest, the student sit-in movement, and the effort which some of us are now making in regard to elections, where we do not honestly feel that either of the major political parties can solve the problem as they are now constructed, we are doing those things by direct action which we feel will splinter the existing political parties, cause a political realignment in which the freedom and justice for all people, including Negroes, can be achieved. Now, this is not a unique position, and certainly, while a controversial one, not so controversial as that which Malcolm X puts before us. And I should like, therefore, to ask him this question. It would seem to me that the logic of your position really is to say to Negroes, or black people in this country, we ought to migrate and set up somewhere in Africa a state in which men are free to follow a particular religious ideal, because it seems to me ultimately this is where you have to come out. I don't see how this escapes as being the logic of your position. You say that perhaps a state will be set up here, but on the other hand, your attitude is if you're not wanted, then you don't want to be where you're not wanted. So why isn't the logic of your position to go to the heart of the matter and take the Garvey position and urge Negroes to return to Africa?
Well, Mr. Reston, number one, when you speak of us striving here to become full-fledged citizens, or as they say, first-class citizens, number one, most of the Negro leaders, the so-called Negro leaders, they have gotten the Negro masses to think in terms of second-class citizenship, which there is no such thing. We who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad look upon a man as either a citizen or he's not a citizen. He's not a citizen by degrees. He's a citizen or he's not a citizen. And as long as the black man in America is not recognized as a first-class citizen, we don't feel that we are citizens at all. No other people in America are placed in a second-class citizenship category. People can come here from Hungary, which is a communist country, and be incorporated or integrated into the American way of life overnight. They don't have to come in as third class, second class, or some other kind of class citizen. The only man that's placed in this category is this so-called Negro who has sat around and begged the white man to accept him as an integral part of his particular political setup and whatnot. Now, we feel that if after 100 years since Lincoln issued the so-called Emancipation Proclamation, if the black man here is still not recognized as a first-class citizen, which means free, then we don't feel that what Lincoln did actually set the so-called Negro free in the first place. Not freedom in its full sense of the word. An example, if you have a unique problem in that if the black man in Nigeria, for instance, strives against his oppressor to gain his freedom, once he gains that freedom, the oppressor leaves. But the black man in Nigeria is already at home. He has his own country. If the black man in India is striving against his oppressor for freedom, once his oppressor, the colonizer, gives him that freedom, the colonizer leaves. The oppressor leaves, but the slave or the ex-slave is already at home. This is the...
Now, this is all well and good, but you are not answering my question.
I'm answering your question.
Right, go ahead.
If the black man in Kenya, the same way, if he rebels against the British, his British oppressor, and gains his freedom, then the oppressor leaves. Now, the black man in America's position is unique in that he begs for freedom or demands for freedom, but once he gets this so-called freedom, he's still 9,000 miles away from that which he can call home. So he has a problem that's different than the problems of the other dark people all over this earth who have been striving for freedom. And where over there, they can use the passive approach, which is sit down or sit in or rebel in that way. When you have in India, like Gandhi, where they had 300 or 400 million black people striving against a couple hundred thousand white oppressors, then passiveness worked, because all they had to do is stop, sit down. It's like an elephant sitting on a mouse or something. But here, they are the majority, and the oppressor is the minority. Here in America, you got the black man is the minority. And when you call yourself sitting down on the white man, all he has to do is let you sit. He can get someone else to run his factory or whatever else he wants to do. But to sit there and use this so-called passive approach, we don't think it will work, because we don't find any parallel. We don't find, for instance, anyone being encouraged to seek freedom in a passive way other than the so-called Negro here in America. Many of the whites who pose as liberals and act as advisors for Negroes tell them that be passive, be peaceful, turn the other cheek. But these same whites who encourage the so-called Negro to use the passive approach have never advocated a passive approach to throw off the yoke of bondage to any white groups of people who are in bondage. When they speak of the whites in Eastern Europe who are under the yoke, the Russian yoke, they don't tell them to be passive in their resistance. They feed them ammunition. They feed them guns. They make heroes out of the freedom fighters from Hungary. They make them great heroes. But when it comes to a black man, be he in Asia or Africa or in America, if he becomes militant in his resistance against oppression, then immediately he's classified as a fanatic. But if it's a white man or a white group or someone in a white country that's trying to throw off bondage, the propagandists label that one as a hero, and they label the dark people who are trying to resist this oppression, be it no matter what kind of resistance it is, they label them as fanatics, as racists, as extremists, or as rebels. So what it does, it makes the black man in America who would like to fight for his freedom or take a militant, uncompromising stand, it makes him reluctant or afraid to take that stand for fear that he'll place himself in this particular category. And I would like to say this, also in answer to your question, that it is not the so-called this kind of movement and that kind of movement in America that's causing the white man to give an inch, and that's all he's giving is an inch. It's the pressure that the white man is under today from the outside world. He is not telling you and me that we might be integrated into his particular educational system or economic system 10 years from now. He's not promising it this year, you know, 10 years from now or 20 years from now or even 50 years from now, because he loves us. But he'll tell you every day. You listen to some of these political speeches. They're catering somewhat to you and me, only because they are in a position where they are forced to try and impress and gain the friendship or the sympathy of the African nations that are getting their independence. The white man today is posing as the leader of the so-called free world. And the only way he can be accepted as the leader of the so-called free world is to be accepted by the majority of the peoples on this earth, the majority of whom are non-white people. And they measure him by how he treats the non-white people here in America. And to impress them, he stands up and talks this old integration talk, which is hypocrisy. Not because he's going to integrate you and me, because we'll still be begging 100 years from now, but to impress our brothers in Africa and Asia, and I don't think that he's going to be successful at it.
Now, am I to take it that what you are saying is that you are really opposed to integration because you don't think it's meaningful and cannot work? Therefore, I come back to my question. Now, you said a great deal about nonviolence, which we should get into, and you've implied a certain number of economic things, but I have to get first your basic position clear in my mind. Otherwise, I don't think the rest of the discussion can be meaningful. You have to answer for me clearly the question as to whether what you ultimately have to see as a logical position is leaving the United States. If for the next 200 years, Negroes are not going to be citizens by your definition, why isn't it logical then for your leader to say, let us find a piece of territory somewhere and go to it? Because either you are advocating the continuation of slavery, if that isn't logical, because you say you can't get it by the methods which I am advocating, which is the slow, grinding process of integration. Now, I want to know where you stand on that, because I can't see other things clearly unless I see this.
I'll try and make it as clear as I can. If by integration, we believe that integration is hypocrisy. If you were going to use the word brotherhood, that's another thing. We don't believe in integration, but we do believe in brotherhood. Integration.
But do you believe brotherhood is possible here?
If any time, sir, you have to pass a law that will make the white man accept you into his society, that's not brotherhood, that's hypocrisy. If a man holds a gun on you to make you put your arm around me and pretend that you love me, that's not brotherhood, that's hypocrisy.
Right.
And if America, if this country has to pass laws to make the white people accept us into their educational system, and has to pass laws to make the white people accept us into their into better housing in their neighborhoods, then what that is, that's the government is holding a gun on the white man and making him pretend that he wants you and me to sit beside him. That is hypocrisy. The government is forcing the white man in America to become a race of hypocrites. Now, if the white man, with no laws passed whatsoever, would accept the black man into his school, would accept the black man into his neighborhood, would accept the black man into his social system, economic system, and political system without laws having to be passed, then we would go for that. We would say that that's brotherhood, that's voluntarily, and it will work.
That's going to happen.
Why, your common sense tells you, sir, that it's not going to happen.
Then, if you cannot do this through the constitutional methods of going into courts, of having laws, which I call integration, and if you cannot do it by the spirit, which you call brotherhood, then what do you see as the future for black people here, and why should they stay?
Sir, the future for the black man in America, as we've been taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, since you can see, and any intelligent person can see, that the white man is just not going to share his wealth with his ex-slave or share his house with his ex-slave, or share his fields with his ex-slave, if the slave keeps pressing him. Sooner or later, there has to be a showdown. If the white man, the slave master, does not want the ex-slave in his house, then he has to let that slave go for himself and find a house for himself. Now, Mr. Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, our leader and teacher, teaches us this, that God has taught him that the only solution for the slave and the slave master is separation.
Ah, so then you do believe in separation.
We absolutely believe in separation.
Right. Now,
we believe that separation is divine.
Right. Now, if there is to be divine separation, are you people being logical? Are you saying then we ought to take over, let us say, an area of the United States which is predominantly Negro and send more and more in until we control it? Or are you being logical by saying, let's get outside of here?
I think both is logical. It's logical when you find that you can't get along with a man in peace to set up house somewhere else. Now, when we say that, when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that God has declared that the black man in America must have some land of his own, that means he must have some land of his own. The land doesn't have to be in Asia. The land doesn't have to be in Africa. The land doesn't have to be in Canada. The land can be anywhere. And if right here in America, since, as you say, we've been such good workers and faithful citizens, I'd rather say faithful servants,
right.
We haven't received any payment for our labor, it would only be just if the master, if his intention is good, since he knows he's not going to bring about this integration, the best thing for him to do is let us have some of these states. And we can go into these states, instead of begging him to live next door to him, we can go into these states and set up farms and feed our own people, set up factories and manufacture clothing and other utilities for our own people, set up businesses where we can make jobs for our own people. And this will keep us from having to beg him for that which he has set up for his people.
Right. In other words, then, Daily News is right in describing your movement as being an apartheid movement. They compared you to South Africa, where they say the whites should be in one place, the Negroes in another. It seems to me that what you're saying is pretty much the same thing.
No, sir. We don't feel that the Daily News is qualified to classify us as anything, or compare us with any South African philosophy, because, number one, the people in South Africa are some people who left Europe and went into Africa, a continent that is not theirs, and took it over from the black people to whom it belonged, and they are now there advocating white supremacy, which is a false doctrine. They're advocating black inferiority, which is another false doctrine. And they're basing their entire governmental system on the continued existence they're staying on a continent that they don't belong in, and also ruling over some people that they have no authority over. We who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are advocating peaceful existence here in this country, which we feel is just as much ours as the white man. It's not his, because he took it from the Indians, and he can't object to us because he brought us here. We didn't come here on our own. We didn't come here voluntarily. He put us in chains and brought us here, and then worked us for nothing for 310 years without paying us one day's labor. Now, I would like to point this out, Mr. Rustin. If you have 100 people who work for you for nothing for a week, you make a profit. If you have 1 million people who work for you for nothing for a year, you become wealthy. Well, then when you have millions of black people whom you can work for nothing for 310 years, you can easily see why America became the wealthiest and the most powerful country on earth faster than any country in history. But here you have 20 million black people today whose parents were worked for 310 years for nothing. What do they have coming for them? Not only did their parents work 310 years for nothing like an animal, but their parents also were the most faithful soldiers that the master had. What payment have they gotten? And today, they're not asking for much. They're not asking for what someone else would ask. Instead of asking for something that's real, they're asking their master to let them occupy one of the rooms in his house or one of the rooms with him in his house. Now, this is still not asking for something. If America gave the black man here half of this country, they wouldn't be giving us anything. They worked our mothers and fathers for 310 years with no pay. The Senate, the Congress, and the U.S. Supreme Court found it necessary to appropriate funds to repay billions of dollars to the Indians for land that was taken from the Indians 300 or 400 years ago. And if this generation of whites will recognize a debt incurred by the former generations of whites to the former generations of Indians, then this same generation of whites also must recognize debts incurred by the former generations of white to your and my forefathers. And if their own courts decree that they should pay the Indian today for what was done to the former generations of Indians, don't you think that God is more just than the court system of America? And if the court system of America says that the Indians must be paid, what do you think God would say that that America must do in payment to 20 million black people who worked here for nothing for 310 years?
All right, I take it then that what you're really saying is that you believe that a certain section of the United States should actually be given over, and because Negroes have worked for it and deserve it, and that that should be their territory, that this is your solution to the problem.
Only solution is separation.
Separation.
Not integration.
Now that we've got that clear, it seems to me we can go back and build on that for me to raise some other questions with you. Now, how do you see the Negro now? And I'm all in favor, you see, of doing away with dope and alcohol and profanity and the like. This is all to the good. But whether you like it or not, this is no answer to the ultimate problem which you face. Now, given the fact that Moses kept the children of Israel in the desert for 40 years in order to do away with their slave mentality and to build up a new leadership, he also had to know precisely where he was going to take them. He had to have a piece of land. Now, you want a piece of land here. Isn't there some inconsistency with your economic policy then in this regard? Because it seems to me what you are saying is Negroes should own their own stores. Negroes should become independent economically. Now, is this possible where you have Negroes spread over the country the way they are? You want them to buy land in Philadelphia and New York and Texas, and what good is this? What are they going to do? Then give it up and move somewhere else? And what is the psychological implications of this?
Well, first, sir, when you mentioned Moses, you mentioned the best example that you probably could have. You pointed out the people that Moses was leading were probably the closest parallel to the problem confronting the so-called Negro in America than any in the Bible. Moses' people were strangers in a land that wasn't theirs. Mm. The black man in America is a stranger in a land that's not his. Mm. Moses' people had a slave mentality. And when they were found, they were worshiping gods other than their own. They were worshiping in a religion other than their own. The Negro in America is the same way. He worships the white man's God, and he's following in the white man's religion. The Negro in America is in the same fix, socially, mentally, politically, economically, and spiritually, as the people whom Moses grew up amongst in so-called in Egypt 4,000 years ago. Now then, if you recall, Moses didn't advocate integration. Moses advocated separation. Nowhere in that Bible can you show me where Moses went to his people and said, "Believe in the same God that your slave master believes in, or seek to integrate yourself with Pharaoh." Moses' one doctrine was separation. He told Pharaoh, "God told me to tell you, let my people go." By go, that meant separate. That did not mean to seek integration in the house of bondage. It did not mean to seek the acceptance of the slave master. It did not mean to seek the friendship even of the slave master. It meant that just what Moses said, "Let my people go." And then he told his people, "If you follow me, I will lead you to a land flowing with milk and honey. Moses never pointed out to anyone where that land was. God had instructed Moses up to that point. But Moses never told the people where he was taking them or what they would have to go through in order to get there. He said, follow me, and I'll lead you to a land flowing with milk and honey. And if you go back in that Bible, you'll find out some of them believed in him, but most of them were afraid of their slave master. They didn't believe that they could get along without Pharaoh. They didn't believe anybody could give them a job if Pharaoh didn't. They didn't believe anybody could put clothes on their back if Pharaoh. That's a slave mentality. They didn't believe that they could have an economic system free of pharaohs. That's a slave mentality. And today the same problem confronts the so-called Negro here in America, and the same problem confronts the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. The same opposition that was put in the path of Moses is put in the path of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad today. If you notice, Pharaoh himself never opposed Moses. He always got magicians to oppose Moses. Today you find your modern slave master. You don't find him opposing the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but he gets Negro, so-called Negro politicians and so-called Negro preachers to work a lot of magic in the eyes of the so-called Negro and make the so-called Negro think that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is a crazy man, just like the magicians tried to make the Hebrews think that Moses was a crazy man. They get magicians to do this work. And the magician is the one who goes to the people and tries to make them think, well, this man Muhammad is crazy. He's going to get you all out here someplace and get all of you killed. But if you recall, and that's why I say I'm so glad that you mentioned that Moses parallel. We feel that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is the modern Moses. Sometimes they refer to Powell as a modern Moses. I've heard them refer to Reverend Martin Luther King as a modern Moses. But no one can be a modern Moses until they first find out what did the ancient Moses do, and he advocated separation, not integration. He advocated complete separation, not integration, and he didn't advocate passive resistance. He advocated an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. What kind of teaching is it when you tell a slave to pray for those who despitefully use you, and it's the slave master who's despitefully using the slave? Love your enemy, and it's the slave master who's an enemy of the slave. As long as you teach a man that kind of philosophy and he eats it up, he'll remain a slave.
Yeah, but you see, I am a great advocate of nonviolence. Now, if you would tell me where it is you're going to lead people, you see, where this land is, I might perhaps say, well, the important thing for me is not to talk about integration or to talk about getting involved in the economic and social and political life in America, because our objective is to get over there. But I don't know where you're going to go, and I don't think you do.
Yes, we do. We can take some land right here, sir.
How?
Right here. It belongs to us.
Yeah, but if you argue that these people are not going to permit you to integrate...
We're not going to integrate.
And if they're not going to be loving enough to accept you, do you think the economic fact is that they're going to give you 10, 12 states that are going to be turned over to Negroes? What states?
Mr. Rustin.
What states?
The predicament that a man is in.
Yeah.
Is what makes a man reach certain decisions, sometimes against his own will. Maybe you don't realize the predicament that America is in today in this world. America probably is in a more precarious position or predicament than any country has been in since time began.
I agree with that. You don't have to fight that.
Now, what is causing this predicament? It's the race problem.
Yes.
Now, who is the primary person involved in this race problem? The so-called Negro.
Right.
America's number one problem is the so-called Negro. What must we do? This is what Uncle Sam is saying. What must I do about this Negro problem? And whenever she's attacked, whenever America is attacked on the race problem in America, she's completely without anything to say. She can say nothing.
Oh, she can say a lot.
What can she say?
I tell you exactly what
How
she can
she
say.
Justify the race problem that consists here?
She doesn't justify it.
What does she do, sir?
She says, and don't misunderstand me, I have spent 25 years of my life, I've been in jail 22 times on the racial question. I've been on the chain gang. But I do not say that her answer is a good one. But it is an answer to meet the situation. She says, up until 1954, we did not have integration of schools. And now we have so many students integrated. Just a minute, let me finish. This is what she says. And she says, Negroes were kept out of trade unions. But now they are being integrated into them. Phil Randolph has set up a new movement for a pressure of the Negro masses on the trade union movement, and things are beginning to give there. America can not justify the race question, but vis-a-vis Africa, Russia, and the others, she's in a very good position to point to a considerable amount of progress, which, incidentally, I don't happen to think is enough. But it is enough to keep the great majority of Negroes in a psychological position where I think you would find it extremely difficult to them to talk about going somewhere else. Now, you talk about Mohammed being able to get 10,000 people. I'm here to tell you that I helped Martin King organize a prayer pilgrimage to Washington in which we got 35,000 people, a youth march in which we got 20,000 people. I simply don't believe that until you have some kind of area where people could go to, Mr. that Preston, the United States is going to take this seriously.
Do you realize if I was a Christian, uh-huh, in a Christian country,
yeah,
I wouldn't brag about out of 170 million people getting in which there are 20 million black people, I wouldn't think it was any accomplishment to get 30,000 to Washington, D.C. for a prayer pilgrimage, when you got the Washington, D.C. itself has got umpteen, everybody down there is a Christian now. When the reason I said 10,000, sir, when you get, like Billy Graham, if he draws 15,000 Christians out to a Christian rally in a Christian country, and then a man comes along who's a Muslim, which is a religion in direct opposition to Christianity, and he draws out the a like number, the accomplishments cannot hardly be compared.
Yeah, and now, may I stop you here for a moment, yeah, because I think we've got to clarify something. When you say the followers of Muhammad are Mohammedans, Muslims.
Not Mohammedan.
Well, Muslims. What you are talking about in reality is not a religious following in the terms of what the Muslim would be in India or Pakistan or a Christian in Europe. Because I maintain that the very term Muslim, while in Mohammed's mind it may be a religious concept, it is a psychological and political concept in the minds of the black men in this country who follow it. Most of them do not read the Quran, they read the Bible. Most of them are essentially and culturally Christians. Why, therefore, do they call themselves Muslim? It is because it is a reaction to Christianity, where in fact they to a large extent still practice it, but don't want to use the term because they don't want to use the same religious terminology that their masters use.
Mr. Rustin, I'm surprised at you.
Well, this is a fact. I'm not talking about your leadership.
No,
I'm
sir,
talking about the mass of your followers.
I'm surprised at you, I mean, sir, in this instance. If you were to go to China and find Muslims, or go to India and mm-hmm. find Muslims, or go to Sudan and find Muslims,
yeah,
their thinking is different. All of them are Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the mosque in Khartoum, you will hear the prayers. But after the prayer, the one who calls the prayer or delivers the sermon will deliver a sermon that's unique and will catch the interest of the people in the Sudan.
Yeah, well, how many mosques do you have in Hawk?
Just a moment, sir. But a man who is delivering a sermon in the Sudan, he wouldn't deliver that same sermon in China, because the sermon is delivered to fit the problems of the people in whose country that sermon is given. And it's the same way here in America. In America, you have a unique problem. You have a problem of 20 million black people who have been transplanted, actually uprooted from their native soil and transplanted in soil that's foreign to them. And after being cut off from their culture for 400 years, when you come to them today with Islam, you are giving them back that which they were taken from 400 years ago.
No, I simply can't agree with this historically. The most of the Negroes who came from Africa, black people, actually came from the west coast of Africa. It was long after the migrations here that Mohammedism spread south. It was in the 17th, it was in the 18th century that the Mohammedism came down into Nigeria and to the extent that it exists in Ghana and Sierra Leone. I think what Mr. most of us were when we came here were worshippers of something quite
this
different.
Is what the white man taught you.
Well,
since, sir, the white man taught you after bringing you here and stripping you of your original culture, getting it completely out of your mind.
This is just what he did.
He stripped you of your native tongue.
But it was not Mohammedism.
Just a moment. Well, sir, in Time magazine, February the 16th, 1959, in an article on Sékou Touré, it speaks of the Mali Empire. The Mali Empire was one of the vastest empires in West Africa.
I know about it.
And it says this. It's speaking of the Mali Empire in Guinea. It says, let me find it here for you, sir. It says, though Africa was, until the Europeans came, the continent that could not write, it had known its times of glory. Guinea was once part of the powerful Mali Empire that stretched from the French Sudan on the upper reaches of the Niger to just short of West Africa's Atlantic coast. When its 14th century ruler, that's a period that predates the discovery of America, Mansour Musa made his pilgrimage to Mecca. He traveled with a caravan of 60,000 men, and among his camels were 80 that each bore 300 pounds of gold. Now, I cite this to say this. This man, this sultan of the Mali Empire, his name was Mansour Musa. Musa is the Arabic pronunciation of Moses. He was a Muslim. He was making the pilgrimage to Mecca. Now, this was the entire Mali Empire. Timbuktu was the capital. Timbuktu was the center of learning. This shows the Muslim influence in that advanced area of West Africa before the discovery of America. Before America was discovered, they say that this man, Mansour Musa, built a swimming pool in the middle of the Sahara Desert. Now, you have to be a genius to build a swimming pool on the seacoast.
Yeah.
Here's a black sultan, just a moment, sir, who built a swimming pool in the middle of the Sahara Desert. He couldn't have been a savage. If he was that far advanced in engineering to build a swimming pool in the middle of the desert, something the white man can hardly do today, you can't say that the man's culture was a savage culture.
Now look, don't beat a dead horse. I am not for a moment trying to say that there was not vast culture in West Africa.
You said that it wasn't Islam.
Just a moment. I said that the Islam spread from Timbuktu to the west coast of Africa.
Timbuktu is on the west coast of Africa.
Well, it's up in, my dear friend.
Timbuktu.
I'm talking about the area from... Yeah, I know
Timbuktu is on the west coast of Africa.
And this is the area here that most of the slaves came from, and not Timbuktu.
Sir, this is Guinea down here. Guinea is a Muslim area, and was a Muslim area in that day. I would like to point out one more thing that the same article says. It will not be easy for Africa to be completely itself. In 4 short months, Guinea has apparently learned that independence is a relative thing. It will not be easy for Africa to be completely itself. For no other continent has been so swept by foreign influence. Islam stretches not only across its top, but deep into the south, as far as the lower reaches of the Belgian Congo.
Now.
Northern Nigeria is as rigidly Muslim as Saudi Arabia, and political meetings in Guinea come to a halt at sunset when everyone troops out, chucks his shoes, and bows toward Mecca.
Now, let me tell you, my friend, just so we get this historically clear, in one illustration. All over the west of Africa, you find the finest art objects out of which Picasso and others developed cubism and modern art.
That's true.
From the carving all over West Africa during the 17th and 18th century of figures with faces, hands. If Mohammedism had really spread, we could not have had those artistic figures. Because, as you ought to know, the Mohammedans are not permitted to create figures in their art objects.
Sir, I think...
And it was the spread of Mohammedism later which was in part due to the destruction of these art objects. Now, this is an historical fact, and I think we ought to get on.
No, sir, there's one more point that I think it should be cleared up. When you spoke of the Muslims who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as not being real Muslims as such, but just using that label to camouflage their continued Christian
practices. Oh, I didn't say camouflage. I said that it was a reaction against. I think camouflage is not quite what I mean.
Yes, in the New York Times Sunday, in an article called Islam is Advancing in West Africa, it says Christians are worried by gains. Lagos, Nigeria. Christian missionaries say they are worried about the advance of Islam in West Africa.
As well they ought to be, because it's spreading rapidly.
They include Bishop of Lagos, a Nigerian and a Roman Catholic churchman who has been in West Africa for many years. The Catholic cleric said, quote, "Christianity here is skin deep only. Some Africans we baptize now go to the mosque and observe Ramadan, the Muslim month of purification," end quote. A British official of 11 years service in Nigeria suggested that Christianity was felt to be the white man's religion and was rejected as contrary to the African personality. An American who works for a philanthropic foundation here said, "Islam is spreading like wildfire. It offers Africans an uncomplicated creed with a few simple tenets."
Right.
Nigeria has just become independent, which has just become independent, already appears well on her way toward becoming a predominantly Muslim nation.
True.
And it's letting you know right here, even the black man in Africa, when he accepts Islam, he doesn't drop all of these other customs overnight. But still he's accepting Islam, he's bearing witness that there's no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the apostle of Allah, and is giving him unity and militancy that he didn't have before.
All right, all I want to say is that the article points out that these people go both to the Christian and to the mosque.
But it points out that when one is converted to Islam, his reaction to it in Africa is no different than the reaction of the black man here in America. Mm-hmm. It's both the same reaction.
I wonder if I could ask a question here. Mr. Rustin, progress in your terms, does it involve a greater sense of racial identity?
I believe that it is very important to have a great sense of racial identity, because I believe that it is quite impossible for people to struggle creatively if they do not truly believe in themselves. I believe that dignity is first. Now this, for me, is doubly important, precisely because believing in integration and not having been told where we are to go, I can see nothing more logical than staying here and struggling for one's rights. Also, because of moral principles which I hold, but leave them aside for the moment, I can see no way for the Negro to struggle except through nonviolence and a dedication to strategic nonviolence as, in a sense, a matter of principle. Now, therefore, if you are going to be able to struggle with nonviolence to a certain extent, you have to have affection for the people who are mistreating you. No affection for the other fellow is possible without a great sense of dignity in oneself. And therefore, the dignity of the Negro, for me, is not something that is an aside. It is an essential of the struggle. The people in Montgomery were able to struggle and get integration on their buses for a simple reason. 10 years before, they could not have done it because they did not believe in themselves. When they believed in themselves, they could then be socially affectionate to the opposition while at the same time being extremely militant and walking and being prepared to sacrifice. I think this is most important, and I would therefore agree with Malcolm X that doing away with the ugliness which our people have had as a result of their poverty and their position is very necessary and important. We can certainly agree here.
Thank you. And you know, I was so happy, Mr. Rustin, to hear you say that dignity is most important. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad absolutely he emphasizes to us the importance of dignity, but you cannot have dignity. Dignity means a high regard for yourself.
Right.
You can't have high regard for that which you have no knowledge of. And when you ask a white man his nationality, for instance, and he says German, immediately he's connected with a German nation, a German flag in the past, a German culture. If he says he's an Englishman, he's connected with England and he's connected with a culture. Now, if you ask a black man in America and he says Negro, right there, he's putting a term on himself that carries more contempt with it than any word that exists in the Webster's Dictionary today. Now, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that the black man in America is not looked down upon because he's black. He's looked down upon because he's called a Negro. A black man can come here from Africa. He's not a Negro. He's an African. He has a culture. A black man from Africa can put on his long flowing robes and have his head ramped up and walk around in Alabama or Mississippi and not run into the same abuses and barriers and pitfalls that you and I would run into here in America, dressed like a white man, speaking like a white man, with the religion of the white man, and with the false conception of history that the white man has brainwashed us with, and at the same time calling ourselves by the white man's name. Now, what Mr. Muhammad says is this: instead of us spending all of our time griping with the white man for the way he has treated us or for what he deprives us of, what we must do is get some dignity, which we cannot have without having a knowledge of ourselves. We must have some kind of cultural knowledge in our background in order for we must know what our parents did and what our foreparents did in order to have high regard for our foreparents. And if you don't have an high regard for your foreparents, you can't regard yourself highly. You take a man who has been taught that his father used to pull a plow and his mother was a maid for the master. He can't look up at his parents. But when you send him back beyond the time that his father was pulling a plow, and back beyond the time when his mother was a maid for the white man, back to the time when he was living along the banks of the Nile in palaces, at the same time the white man was living in the caves of Europe, and history will bear that out, or at a time when he was wearing silk in the East and in Africa and Asia, at a time when the white man whom he regards so highly today didn't know what clothes were, at a time when he was cooking and seasoning his food, when at the same time the white man whom he idolizes and worships today didn't know what cooked food was, then when you go back then and find out what a great history that the black man had, how his foreparents were the ones who engineered the pyramids, and how that the head or the face on the Sphinx in Africa, which is one of the oldest statues on this earth, is not a European, but it's a black man. He begins to look back there and see that his people were somebody. He begins immediately to throw off this inferior attitude, and he begins to look up at himself. And then he stops abusing himself. He stops getting drunk. He stops trying to escape from the surroundings or the conditions that he's in by turning to dope or alcohol.
Well,
he
look,
begins to toss aside these abuses.
I agree thoroughly. And I am at the present time doing some work on the Ga Empire. Precisely,
sir,
because I think this is important.
It's very important.
But now let me ask you another question, because I want to clarify your position on the Jewish question. Where does your group come out on this question? Because I don't want to tell you what I've heard.
You've heard, and I'll clarify it.
Well, I have been given to understand that your position is, particularly in Harlem, that the Jews dominate. That one of the reasons that the Negro is so depressed is that the Jews are exploiting him, and that the Jews are attempting to exploit the Arab world and stir up difficulties in the Middle East. Now, I'd like to know whether this is a misunderstanding I have.
I should say that we only have a few minutes more.
Yes, sir. If you, sir, will read what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has written, and he has written much,
mm-hmm.
I don't think you can find an article where he has ever pointed out the Jew as an exploiter of the black man. He speaks of the exploiter, period. He doesn't break it down in terms of a Frenchman or an Englishman or a Jew or a German. He speaks of the exploiter. And Sometimes the man who is the most guilty of exploitation will think that you're pointing the finger at him and put out the propaganda that you're anti-this or that you're anti-that. We make no distinction between exploitation and exploiter.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you mean when you say the man who is the most exploiting will put out propaganda?
I say this, that usually when you find a man putting out propaganda against Muslims, usually that man feels that the finger is being pointed at him. But
in other words, you think that many Jews feel that way?
I don't know. Uh-huh. But I say that you cannot find anything that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has written or said that at any time will label the Jew as an exploiter. Mm-hmm. No, sir, but he speaks about the exploitation and the oppression and the deception that has been used against the black people of America. Now, the man that is guilty, let whoever is guilty wear that shoe. Mm-hmm. But he has never made a distinction between a Frenchman, again I say, or a Jew or a German or what have you. The exploiter is the exploiter. I don't care what kind of label you put on him, and he can't duck it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bayard Rustin. And Mr. Malcolm X.
Thank you, Mr. Donald.
It's been very good to be here. Thank you.